way that the world has not forgotten about Palestine, and to try once again to attempt to break the siege and open up the humanitarian corridor and deliver the extremely needed humanitarian aid, then that is a risk I'm willing to take, and it's something that we just simply have to do. We cannot just sit around and do nothing and watch this live stream genocide unfold in front of our very eyes. So we are doing this because we are human beings who care about justice. And when our complicit governments fail to step up, it falls on us, unfortunately, to do so.
And Greta, could you talk about how you see the issue of Palestinian freedom connecting to or intersecting with the issue that you're best known for, which is climate change activism?
Yeah, for me, there's no way of distinguishing the two. We cannot have climate justice without social justice. The reason why I am a climate activist is not because I want to protect trees. I'm a climate activist because I care about human and planetary well-being, and those are extremely interlinked. For example, when we see the genocide in Gaza, of course, there are some very obvious links that ecocide, environmental destruction, is a very common method used in war and to oppress people. But also, it should be much simpler than that. No matter what the cause of the suffering is, whether that is CO2, whether that is bombs, whether that is state repression or other forms of violence, we have to stand up against that source of suffering. If we pretend to care about the environment, if we pretend to care about the climate, and our children's future, without seeing and acknowledging and fighting against the suffering of all marginalized people today, then that is an extremely racist approach to justice, that excludes the majority of the world's population.
And how? What is the mood aboard the ship? You have participants from Brazil, France, Germany, Spain, and you yourself are Swedish. What's the mood there?
The mood on board the ship is, I would say, that our spirits are very high and we are very determined to continue. So far, we have won over one of the major predicted obstacles, which is to be stuck in port due to the bureaucratic warfare that has been very strong, especially in the past. And the fact that we have gotten over that and that we are out sailing now and that we have gotten quite a far bit is already a victory in itself. Of course, this mission includes many risks, and we have done many risk assessments. But of course, we deem the risk of silence and the risk of inaction to be so much more deadly than this mission, of course. And we are 12 peaceful volunteers who are not carrying weapons. We are carrying food, medical supplies, and sanitary products and other very needed humanitarian aid into Gaza following the blockade. We will meet whatever is thrown at us with nonviolence in any scenario. We are trying to prepare and to maximize our safety and the success of this mission as much as we can.
Greta, as you attempt to bring in baby formula, medical kits, flour, prosthetics for kids with amputations, the Israeli military has threatened to block the Freedom Flotilla. The Israeli army says it's prepared to raid your ship. We know what happened to the Mavi Marmara with the Israeli raid and the killing of 9 activists on board. Ultimately, a 10th died. Are you seeing drones? How are you prepared to deal?
Yeah, Yeah, we are seeing drones. Last night, there were two different moments where there were drones circulating above us. And we have safety procedures that we will use. And we have different scenarios that we are prepared for to try to maximize our safety in a nonviolent way. So we are trying to do our very best. And it shows quite a bit that peaceful volunteers who are carrying humanitarian aid and necessary for survival is being threatened to be raided, intercepted, or attacked. I think that says quite a lot about the priorities and approaches of Israel right now. But we must also remember that this mission is not about us. It is not about the voyage or the people on board. This mission is about Palestine. It is about the genocide, the occupation, ethnic cleansing, and the other methods of war and oppression that are being used by Israel against the Palestinians. And we do not only need humanitarian aid to be let into Gaza. We do not only need a ceasefire. We need an end to the occupation.
Do you plan to break the military blockade around Gaza?
Sorry, what did you say?
How do you plan to break the military blockade around Gaza?
We are planning to continue sailing until we cannot sail anymore. It is very difficult to predict what scenario it will be, but as far as we know, we are planning to continue as we are now.
And what is your message to folks around the world, especially to young people who throughout the advanced countries seem to have much more interest and dedication to ending the war in Gaza?
My message is that right now, international law is failing us. International institutions, our governments are failing us. Media, our companies are all failing us. Or failing us is a diplomatic way of saying that our system seems to be designed in a way that is built upon exploitation and oppression of people. And so there's no one to turn to. There's no one we can turn to rescue the situation. But it falls on us to step up, to continue flooding the streets, to continue organizing, boycotting, to speak up on all platforms, to try to send a clear message that we will not stand for what is happening right now.
According to Al Jazeera, Greta, they're saying, according to flight radar, which tracks aircraft movements, an Israel-made Hellenic Coast Guard drone, IAI Heron UAV, hovered over the Madeleine ship. The drone's deployment was confirmed by the Greek Ministry of Defense. We're speaking to you from the United States, where the South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham wrote on X, "Hope Greta and her friends can swim." Your response?
We can swim very well. It says a lot about their priorities that in the face of genocide and systematic starvation of 2 million people, lawmakers, elected officials whose responsibility it should be to serve the people and to protect the people, that they, rather than ending their complicity in genocide and the mass slaughtering of civilians, are focusing on mocking people who are at least trying to do their bit. I think that says everything we need to know about their priorities.
And finally, your message to Palestinians who perhaps have read about or heard about your voyage or waiting your arrival, what is your message to them?
My message to them would be that we stand behind you in every step of the way. We are standing in solidarity with you. We see you. And I am also my deepest apologies on behalf of the outside world, especially the Western world, that we continue to betray you and that more people are not stepping up. But I promise that at least we here will try our very best to stand up for you and to support you in your struggle.
Greta, we wish you all safety. Greta Thunberg, internationally renowned Swedish climate activist who inspired the global youth climate strike. She's won the Right Livelihood Award, has also been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, was speaking to us aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla's vessel Madeleine, which is on a voyage from Sicily to Gaza, carrying life-saving aid in an attempt to break Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip. It's day three of what they expect to be a seven-day trip. We'll continue to follow it. Next up is Republican lawmakers move to ban states from regulating artificial intelligence. We'll speak to the journalist Karen Hall, author of the new book Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's Open AI. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the Empire of AI. That's the name of a new book by the journalist Karen Howe, who has closely reported on the rise of the artificial intelligence industry with a focus on Sam Altman's OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. Karen Howe compares the actions of the AI industry to those of colonial powers in the past. She writes, quote, "The empires of AI are not engaged in the same overt violence and brutality that marked this history, but they, too, seize and extract precious resources to feed their vision of artificial intelligence. The work of artists and writers, the data of countless individuals posting about their experiences and observations online, the land, energy, and water required to house and run massive data centers and supercomputers," she writes. Karen Howe's book comes at a time when Republican Congress members are trying to block states from regulating AI. The House recently passed Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget Bill that contains a provision that would prohibit any state-level regulations of AI for the next decade, in a major gift to the AI industry. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has criticized the provision, even though she voted for the bill. She wrote online, quote, "Full transparency, I did not know about this section. I'm adamantly opposed to this, and it's a violation of state rights, and I would have voted no if I had known this was in there." She says she won't vote for it if it remains in there after the Senate votes. To talk about this and much more, we're joined by the journalist Karen Howe, whose new book, again, is just out, Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's OpenAI, former reporter at The Wall Street Journal and MIT Technology Review. She leads the Pulitzer Center's AI Spotlight Series program for training journalists on how to cover AI. You should train everyone on how to understand AI, Karen. It's an amazing book.
Thank you so much.
Don't you start by talking about the title, what exactly you mean? For a lay audience, I suspect a lot of our audience are Luddites, so you really have to explain what artificial intelligence, artificial general intelligence is.
So AI is a collection of many different technologies, but most people were introduced to it through ChatGPT. And what I argue in the book and what the title refers to, Empire of AI, it's actually a critique of the specific trajectory of AI development that led us to ChatGPT and has continued since ChatGPT. And that is specifically Silicon Valley's scale at all costs approach to AI development. AI models in modern day, they are trained on data. They need computers to train them on that data. But what Silicon Valley did and what OpenAI did in the last few years is they started blowing up the amount of data and the size of the computers that need to do this training. So we are talking about the full English language internet being fed into these models, books, scientific articles, all of the intellectual property that is being created, and also massive supercomputers that run tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of computer chips that are the size of dozens, maybe hundreds of football fields, and use practically the entire energy demands of cities now. So this is an extraordinary type of AI development that is causing a lot of social labor and environmental harms. And that is ultimately why I evoke this analogy to empire.
And Karen, could you talk some more about not only the energy requirements, but the water requirements of these huge data centers that are in essence, the backbone of this widening industry?
Absolutely. I'll give you two stats on both the energy and the water. When talking about the energy demand, McKinsey recently came out with a report that said in the next 5 years, based on the current pace of AI computational infrastructure expansion, we would need to put as much energy on the global grid as what is consumed by 2 to 6 times the energy consumed annually by the state of California. And that will mostly be serviced by fossil fuels. We're already seeing reporting of coal plants with their lives being extended. They were supposed to retire, but now they cannot to support this data center development. We are seeing methane gas turbines, unlicensed ones, being popped up to service these data centers as well. From a fresh water perspective, these data centers need to be trained on fresh water. They cannot be trained on any other type of water because it can corrode the equipment, it can lead to bacterial growth, and most of the time, it actually taps directly into a public drinking water supply because that is the infrastructure that has been laid to deliver this clean, fresh water to different businesses, to different homes. And Bloomberg recently had an analysis where they looked at the expansion of these data centers around the world, and two-thirds of them are being placed in water-scarce areas. So they're being placed in communities that do not have access to fresh water. So it's not just the total amount of fresh water that we need to be concerned about, but actually the distribution of this infrastructure around the world.
And most people are familiar with ChatGPT, the consumer aspect of AI. But what about the military aspect of AI, where, in essence, we're finding Silicon Valley companies becoming the next generation of defense contractors?
One of the reasons why OpenAI and many other companies are turning to the defense industry is because they have spent an extraordinary amount of money in developing these technologies. They're spending hundreds of billions to train these models, and they need to recoup those costs. And there are only so many industries and so many places that have that size of a paycheck to pay. And so that's why we're seeing a cozying up to the defense industry. We're also seeing Silicon Valley use the U.S. government in their empire building ambitions. You could argue that the U.S. government is also trying to use Silicon Valley, vice versa, in their empire building ambitions. But certainly, these technologies are not designed to be used in a sensitive military context. And so the aggressive push of these companies to try and get those defense contracts and integrate their technologies more and more into the infrastructure of the military is really alarming.
I wanted to go to the countries you went to or the stories you covered. I mean, this is amazing, the depth of your reporting. From Kenya to Uruguay to Chile. You were talking about the use of water, and I also want to ask you about nuclear power. Yeah. But in Chile, what is happening there around these data centers and the water they would use and the resistance to that?
Yeah. So Chile has an interesting history in that it was under a dictatorship for a very long time. And so during that time, most public resources were privatized, including water. because of an anomaly, there's one community in the greater Santiago metropolitan region that actually still has access to a public freshwater resource that services both that community as well as the rest of the country in emergency situations. That is the exact community that Google chose to try to put a data center in. And they proposed for their data center to use 1,000 times more fresh water than that community used annually.
And it would be free.
And it, you know, I have no idea. That is a great question. But what the community told me was they weren't even paying taxes for this because they believed, based on reading the documentation, that the taxes that Google was paying was, in fact, to where they had registered their offices, their administrative offices, not where they were putting down the data center. So they were not seeing any benefit from this data center directly to that community. And they were seeing no checks placed on the fresh water that this data center would have been allowed to extract. And so these activists said, wait a minute. Absolutely not. We're not going to allow this data center to come in unless they give us a legitimate reason for why it benefits us. And so they started doing boots on the ground activism, pushing back, knocking on every single one of their neighbors' doors, handing out flyers to the community, telling them, this company is taking our freshwater resources without giving us anything in return. And so they escalated so dramatically that it escalated to Google Chile. It escalated to Google Mountain View, which, by the way, then sent representatives to Chile that only spoke English. But then it eventually escalated to the Chilean government. And the Chilean government now has roundtables where they ask these community residents and the company representatives and representatives from the government to come together to actually discuss how to make data center development more beneficial to the community. The activists say it is the fight is not over. Just because they've been invited to the table doesn't mean that everything is suddenly better. They need to stay vigilant. They need to continue scrutinizing these projects. But thus far, they've been able to block this project for 4 to 5 years and have gained that seat at the table.
And how is it that these Western companies, in essence, are exploiting labor in the global South? You go into something called data annotation firms. What are those?
Yeah, so because AI, modern day AI systems are trained on massive amounts of data and they're that's scraped from the internet, you can't actually pump that data directly into your AI model because there are a lot of things within that data. It's heavily polluted. It needs to be cleaned. It needs to be annotated. So this is where data annotation firms come in. These are middleman firms that hire contract labor to provide to these AI companies to do that kind of data preparation. And OpenAI, when it was starting to think about commercializing its products and thinking about, let's put text generation machines that can spew any kind of text into the hands of millions of users, they realized they needed to have some kind of content moderation. They needed to develop a filter that would wrap around these models and prevent these models from actually spewing racist, hateful, and harmful speech to users that would not make a very good commercially viable product. And so they contracted these middleman firms in Kenya, where the Kenyan workers had to read through reams of the worst text on the internet, as well as AI-generated text where OpenAI was prompting its own AI models to imagine the worst text on the internet, and then telling these Kenyan workers to categorize them in detailed taxonomies of, is this sexual content? Is this violent content? How graphic is that violent content? In order to teach its filter all the different categories of content it had to block. And this is an incredibly uncommon form of labor. There are lots of other different types of contract labor that they use. But these workers, they're paid a few bucks an hour, if at all. And just like the era of social media, these content moderators are left very deeply psychologically traumatized. And ultimately, there is no real philosophy behind why these workers are paid a couple bucks an hour and have their lives destroyed, and why AI researchers who also contribute to these models are paid million-dollar compensation packages simply because they sit in Silicon Valley in OpenAI's offices. That is the logic of empire, and that harkens back to my title, Empire of AI.
So let's go back to your title, Empire of AI, the subtitle, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI. So tell us the story of Sam Altman and what OpenAI is all about, right through to the deal he just made in the Gulf when President Trump, Sam Altman and Elon Musk were there.
Altman is very much a product of Silicon Valley. His career was first as a founder of a startup and then as the president of Y Combinator, which is one of the most famous startup accelerators in Silicon Valley, and then the CEO of OpenAI. And there's no coincidence that OpenAI ended up introducing the world to the scale at all costs approach to AI development, because that is the way that Silicon Valley has operated in the entire time that Altman came up in it. And so he is a very strategic person. He is incredibly good at telling stories about the future and painting these sweeping visions that investors and employees want to be a part of. And so early on at YC, he identified that AI would be one of the trends that could take off. And he was trying to build a portfolio of different investments and different initiatives to place himself in the center of various different trends, depending on which one took off. He was investing in quantum computing, he was investing in nuclear fusion, he was investing in self-driving cars, and he was developing a fundamental AI research lab. Ultimately, the AI research lab was the ones that started accelerating really quickly, so he makes himself the CEO of that company. And originally, he started it as a nonprofit to try and position it as a counter to for-profit-driven incentives in Silicon Valley. But within 1.5 years, OpenAI's executives identified that if they wanted to be the lead in this space, they had to go for this scale-at-all-cost approach, and had to should be in quotes. They thought that they had to do this. There are actually many other ways to develop AI and to have progress in AI that does not take this approach. But once they decided that, they realized the bottleneck was capital. It just so happens Sam Altman is a once-in-a-generation fundraising talent. He created this new structure, nesting a for-profit arm within the nonprofit to become this fundraising vehicle for the tens of billions and ultimately hundreds of billions that they needed to pursue the approach that they decided on. And that is how we ultimately get to present-day OpenAI, which is one of the most capitalistic companies in the history of Silicon Valley, continuing to raise hundreds of billions, and Altman has joked even trillions, to produce a technology that ultimately has a middling economic impact thus far.
And we only have about a minute left, but the relationship between Altman and other rivals like Google or Elon Musk?
It is accelerating the development of this technology that, again, I mentioned has this middling impact. We've seen through the history of OpenAI that all of the former executives that have left have created their own rivals. So Elon Musk was one of the original co-founders, created XAI. Ilya Sutskever was the chief scientist, created Safe Superintelligence. Mira Murati was the former chief technology officer, created Thinking Machines Lab. All of them are now competing to try and dominate this technology and try and make it in their own image.
And finally, this regulation within the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that says AI can't be regulated by states for a decade?
This is absolutely going to enshrine the impunity of Silicon Valley into law. I mean, I call this these empires of AI because they are already quickly becoming the apex predator in the ecosystem, able to act in their self-interest. And that bill, if passed, would certainly codify that.
Well, we're going to do a part two posted online at democracynow.org. Karen Howe is author of Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's OpenAI. Tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! When we speak with the British journalist Carol Cadwallader about how to survive the Broligarchy. We've got three job openings, senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology, all full-time here in New York. You can learn more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Wuerer, Shireen Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
the strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Radio Rewind.